Hello and welcome to the reading of the Globe Gazette for March 13, 2024. I'm your reader, Craig Shives. On the front page, the lead article is entitled "Panel Hears from Special Counsel." Transcript: President said he didn't intentionally take papers home. Lawmakers turned a Tuesday hearing on President Joe Biden's handling of classified documents into a proxy battle between the Democratic president and Republican frontrunner Donald Trump, as a newly released transcript of Biden's testimony last fall showed he repeatedly insisted he never meant to retain classified information after he left the vice presidency. Special Counsel Robert Hur, testifying for more than 4 hours before the House Judiciary Committee, stood steadfastly by the assessments in his 345-page report that questioned Biden's age and mental competence, but recommended no criminal charges for the 81-year-old president, finding insufficient evidence to make a case stand up in court. "What I wrote is what I believe the evidence shows, and what I expect jurors would perceive and believe," Hur said. "I did not sanitize my explanation, nor did I disparage the president unfairly." The transcript of hours of interviews between Biden and the special counsel, released on Tuesday, provide a more textured picture of the roughly year-long investigation, filling in some of the gaps left by Hur's and Biden's accounting of the exchanges. While Biden was adamant that he treated classified information seriously, the transcript shows he was at times fuzzy about dates and details, and he said he was unfamiliar with the paper trail for some of the sensitive documents he handled. The hearing played out as both Biden and Trump were on the cusp of claiming their party's nominations, and the party lines calcified almost immediately over which leader meant to hang on to classified documents, or rather who, quote, willfully, close quote, retained them, and who didn't. And Hur was the rare witness vilified all around by Republicans angry over his decision not to charge the president, and by Democrats for his unflattering commentary about Biden. Republicans argued Biden was given a pass by his own Justice Department, and that Trump was unfairly victimized by prosecutors. Democrats, for their part, stressed Biden's cooperation in the investigation and strongly contrasted that with the separate criminal case against Trump, who refused to return classified documents requested by the National Archives that he had at his Florida estate. Biden's team returned the documents after they were discovered, and the president cooperated with the investigation by voluntarily sitting for an interview and consenting to searches of his homes. Trump, by contrast, is accused of enlisting the help of aides and lawyers to conceal the documents from the government and seeking to have potentially incriminating evidence destroyed. Hur, in his report, detailed how his findings about Biden were far different from those of Special Counsel Jack Smith about Trump, who has been charged with willfully retaining classified documents. FBI agents searched Trump's Florida estate in 2022 and removed boxes of documents marked as classified after he refused multiple requests from the National Archives to return them. Representative Jerry Nadler of New York, the committee's ranking Democrat, asked whether Biden's willingness to comply with investigators and turn over documents contributed to the decision not to charge him. "That was a factor in our analysis," Hur said. But the Democrats quickly bored into Hur, who was chosen by Biden's own attorney general, suggesting he was a political partisan doing Republican bidding via his written slights about Biden's age and memory. Hur took issue with the characterization. "Politics played no part whatsoever in my investigative steps, my decisions, and the words that I put in my report," Hur responded. Republicans, meanwhile, questioned how the two cases were really all that different. Representative Tom McClintock, Republican from California, called it a glaring double standard. Donald Trump's being prosecuted for exactly the same act that you documented Joe Biden committed, he told her. Her's report cited evidence that Biden willfully held on to highly classified information and shared it with a ghostwriter, based on audio of the conversations between the two men in which Biden said he had just come across some classified documents at his home. According to the transcript, Biden told her he did not recall the exchange or that he had actually discovered any documents. He said if he had discussed anything questionable with the ghostwriter, it was in referring to a 20-page sensitive memo he had written to then-President Barack Obama in 2009, arguing against surging troops in Afghanistan that he wanted to ensure didn't make it into publication. Hur said he was aware of the need to explain in great detail why he decided not to charge the president and why the case didn't meet the standard for criminal charges. Such explanations are common but usually kept confidential. But there's a tradition in the Justice Department to release such documents publicly. And so, as Hur was working on his report, he almost certainly would have understood that the document was going to see the light of the day. The need to show my work was especially strong here, Hur said. The Attorney General had appointed me to investigate the actions of the Attorney General's boss, the sitting President of the United States. I knew that for my decision to be credible, I could not simply announce that I recommended no criminal charges and leave it at that. I needed to explain why. He added that, quote, the evidence and the president himself put his memory squarely at issue, close quote. Also on the front page, an article entitled Officials, Homemade Machine Guns Help Fuel Violence in U.S. Cheap devices turn weapons from semi to fully automatic. 11-year-old Dominic Davis was not far from his mom's Cincinnati home when a hail of gunfire sprayed out from a passing car. Nearly 24 rounds hurtled through the night at a group of children in the blink of an eye. 4 other children and a woman were hurt in the November shooting that killed Dominic, who had just made his school basketball team. What happened? How does this happen to an 11-year-old? He was only a few doors down, said his father, Isaac Davis. The shooting remains under investigation, but federal investigators believe the 22 shots could be fired off with lightning speed because the weapon was illegally converted to fire like a machine gun. Communities around the U.S. have seen shootings carried out with weapons converted to fully automatic in recent years, fueled by a staggering increase in small pieces of metal or plastic made with a 3D printer or ordered online. Laws against machine guns date back to the bloody violence of Prohibition-era gangsters. Devices known by nicknames such as Glock switches, Auto Sears, and Chips allow people to transform legal semi-automatic weapons into even more dangerous guns, helping fuel today's gun violence, police and federal authorities say. Police officers are facing down fully automatic weapon fire in amounts that haven't existed in this country since the days of Al Capone and the Tommy gun, said Steve Dettelbach, director of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives, or ATF. It's a huge problem. The agency reported a 570% increase in the number of conversion devices collected by police departments between 2017 and 2021, the most recent data available. Guns with conversion devices have been used in several mass shootings, including one that left 4 dead at a Sweet 16 party in Alabama last year, and another that left 6 people dead at a bar district in Sacramento, California, in 2022. In Houston, police officer William Jeffrey died in 2021 after being shot with a converted gun while serving a warrant. In cities such as Indianapolis, police have seized such devices every week. The devices that can convert legal semi-automatic weapons can be made on a 3D printer in about 35 minutes, or ordered from overseas online for less than $30. They're also quick to install. Once in place, they modify the gun's machinery. Instead of firing one round each time the shooter squeezes the trigger, a semi-automatic weapon with a conversion device starts firing as soon as the trigger goes down and doesn't stop until the shooter lets go or the weapon runs out of ammunition. You're seeing them a lot in stunning numbers, particularly in street violence, said David Puccino, deputy chief counsel at Giffords Law Center. In a demonstration by ATF agents, the firing of a semi-automatic outfitted with a conversion device was nearly indistinguishable from an automatic weapon. Conversion devices with differing designs can fit a range of different guns, enabling guns to fire at a rate of 800 or more bullets per minute, according to the ATF. It takes 2 or 3 seconds to put in some of these devices into a firearm to make that firearm into a machine gun instantly, Dettelbach said. Between 2012 and 2016, police departments in the U.S. found 814 conversion devices and sent them to the ATF. That number grew to more than 5,400 between 2017 and 2021, according to the agency's most recent data. They took hold in Minneapolis in 2021 and helped fuel record-breaking gun violence that year, City Police Chief Brian O'Hara said. Along with spraying out bullets at a dizzying speed, switches make a gun much more difficult for the shooter to control, so more people can be hit by accident. The thing is shaking as it's firing, so we wind up getting multiple victims, people hit in extremities during the same shooting incident because the person cannot control the weapon, O'Hara said. The city has seen a decline in their use since the September 2022 arrest of a man charged with selling switches that he ordered from Russia and Taiwan or made himself, O'Hara said. But it's still a very, very real problem, he said. This is having a really deep impact on families, on neighborhoods, and communities. While the devices are considered illegal machine guns under federal law, many states don't have their own specific laws against them. In Indiana, police were finding them so often, multiple times a week in the state's capital, that the state changed the law to ensure it included switches. We have to update the laws regarding machine guns to deal with the problems of today, Indianapolis Police Chief Chris Bailey said. Only 15 states have their own laws against the possession, sale, or manufacture of automatic fire weapons, according to Giffords. Indiana is one of many states that have regulations with exceptions. 5 states have no state-level machine gun regulations at all. On page 2, we have an article entitled "Transcript Complicates Accounts of Biden Interview." The White House knew it had a political problem on its hands when a special counsel report questioned President Joe Biden's memory last month. But Biden saw a much more personal affront as well. Robert Herr, who was appointed to investigate whether Biden mishandled classified documents, wrote that the president couldn't recall in an interview with prosecutors the date when his son Beau died of cancer. It was a shocking contention about a keystone event in Biden's life, and it fed into questions about whether the 81-year-old president is fit to serve another term. "How in hell dare he raise that?" Biden angrily declared during a news conference after the report was released. "Frankly, when I was asked the question, I thought to myself it wasn't any of their damn business." The reality of the situation, however, isn't as clear as either Biden or her portrayed, according to a transcript of the interview released Tuesday before the former special counsel testified on Capitol Hill. Her didn't ask the president about his son's death. Biden brought it up himself during a discussion about how he stored documents at a rental home in Virginia after leaving the vice president's office in 2017. Biden recalled a specific date that Beau died, though he briefly wondered aloud about the year as the conversation toggled between various events. What month did Beau die, Biden mused. Oh, God. May 30th. A White House lawyer interjected by saying 2015. Was it 2015 he died? Biden asked. When someone responded affirmatively, the president added it was 2015. Biden aides defended the president's inaccurate characterization of the interview during his news conference last month, describing his responses as visceral and emotional. They said his exchange with her showed how Biden believed it was important to reflect on how his son's death affected his decision-making. Her, in his testimony before the House Judiciary Committee, said his report's discussion of Biden's memory was necessary and accurate and fair because his state of mind was an important part of evaluating whether he committed a crime. I did not sanitize my explanation, nor did I disparage the president unfairly, he said. Asked why Biden angrily accused her of raising his son's death when the transcript shows otherwise, White House spokesman Ian Sams responded that the president was being asked about Beau generally, including the book that the president wrote. He thought it was outrageous and inappropriate for that report to include such an inappropriate and extraneous comment like that, especially when it's clear that he says the day his son died, Sam said. So I think that you saw the anger and emotional reaction of a father who still experiences the pain of that loss every single day. Though the special counsel's investigation found no basis to bring criminal charges against Biden, unlike Donald Trump, who was indicted for refusing to return classified records to the federal government, the references to his memory threatened the president's ability to assure voters that he can keep doing his job until he turns 86. Beau was Delaware's attorney general and widely viewed as his father's political heir when he was diagnosed with a brain tumor. The cancer, which Biden connects to his son's National Guard service near toxic burn pits on military bases in Iraq, was devastating for a family that already suffered tragedy decades earlier. Shortly after Biden was elected to the Senate in 1972, his first wife and baby daughter were killed in a car crash that also badly injured Beau and his younger brother, Hunter. Beau died while Biden was serving as vice president, and his deep sorrow helped deter him from running for president in 2016, when Trump ultimately defeated Hillary Clinton. Biden mentioned the death during an interview that Her conducted October 8. They were discussing where Biden kept documents that he was, quote, actively working on at his Virginia home. The president responded by skipping back a few years to talk about how, quote, in this timeline, my son is either been deployed or is dying, period, close quote. After the brief exchange about the specific date, Biden began to talk about writing his book, Promise Me, Dad, which was released in 2017. This is personal, he said, as he talked about how, quote, Beau was like my right arm and Hunt was my left. Close quote. Her offered Biden a break at this point, but the president insisted on continuing with a lengthy story about his family. Biden said how Beau, after he was diagnosed with cancer, made him promise not to step away from public life. Biden decided I couldn't handle another run for president, but he would, quote, stay involved, close quote. However, in a story that Biden frequently told at fundraisers, he changed course after the white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, in 2017, and Trump's response that there were, quote, very fine people on both sides, close quote. Biden said that he is, quote, the antithesis, close quote, of everything that this, quote, guy stood for, close quote, and, quote, I could beat him, close quote. As he wrapped up the story, Biden wondered aloud whether Herr needed such a lengthy answer. Sorry for the detail, Biden said. No apology necessary, Herr replied. On page 3, an article entitled U.S. Will Provide Weapons, Dems Launch Long Shot Effort to Push a Vote on Foreign Funding Bill. The Pentagon will rush about $300 million in weapons to Ukraine after finding some cost savings in its contracts, the White House said Tuesday, though the military remains deeply overdrawn and needs at least $10 billion to replenish the weapons it pulled from its stocks to help Kyiv in its fight against Russia. It's the Pentagon's first announced security package for Ukraine since December, when it acknowledged it was out of replenishment funds. It wasn't until recent days that officials publicly acknowledged they weren't just out of replenishment funds, but $10 billion overdrawn. The announcement comes as Ukraine runs low on munitions and efforts to get fresh funds for weapons stalled in the House because of Republican opposition. House Democrats and a small group of centrist Republicans on Tuesday launched separate long-shot efforts to force a vote on tens of billions of dollars in wartime aid for Ukraine, intensifying pressure on Speaker Mike Johnson, a Republican from Louisiana, to take up the foreign funding package. Democrats, as the minority in the House, began gathering signatures to force a floor vote on the Senate's $95 billion package of aid for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan through a, quote, discharge petition, close quote, a seldom successful procedural tool that can circumvent the Speaker's control over which bills come up for a vote. Shortly after, a group of Republicans launched their own signature drive for a bill that would trim the package to $66 billion, mostly for military aid, and include border security provisions. For either petition to trigger action in the House, it must be signed by a majority of lawmakers, or 218 members. With Republicans controlling the House, 219 to 213, at least some Republicans would have to buck their leadership and sign the Democratic-backed petition to reach a majority. Some progressive Democrats are unlikely to sign on because the legislation includes military aid for Israel. Meanwhile, Ukrainian long-range drones smashed into two oil facilities deep inside Russia on Tuesday, officials said. While an armed incursion claimed by Ukraine-based Russian opponents of the Kremlin unnerved a border region in a cross-border ground assault. The Russian Defense Ministry said Moscow's military and security forces killed 234 fighters while thwarting the incursion. It also said the attackers lost 7 tanks and 5 armored vehicles. From the Middle East, we have an article entitled Ship Stocked with Aid Sets Sail. The charity mission is separate from U.S. plans to build a floating dock. Rafah, Gaza Strip, an aid ship loaded with some 200 tons of food, set sail for Gaza on Tuesday in a pilot program for the opening of a sea corridor to the territory, where the 5-month-old Israel-Hamas war has driven hundreds of thousands of Palestinians to the brink of starvation. The push to get food in by sea, along with a recent campaign of airdrops into isolated northern Gaza, highlighted the international community's frustration with the growing humanitarian crisis and its inability to get aid in by road. The food on the aid ship was collected by the World Central Kitchen charity and is being transported by the Spanish aid group Open Arms. The ship departed from Cyprus and is expected to arrive in Gaza in 2 to 3 days. The U.S. has separately announced plans to construct a floating dock near Gaza to deliver aid, but it will likely be weeks before it is operational. 4 U.S. Army boats with equipment and steel pier segments left Virginia on Tuesday, headed to Gaza. President Joe Biden's administration has provided military aid for Israel while urging it to facilitate more humanitarian access. The war, triggered by Hamas' October 7 attack on Israel, has killed more than 30,000 Palestinians and driven most of Gaza's 2.3 million people from their homes. A quarter of Gaza's population is starving, according to the United Nations. The U.S., Qatar, and Egypt tried to broker a ceasefire and hostage release ahead of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, which began at sundown Sunday. The talks stalled as Hamas demanded any temporary pause in the fighting come with guarantees for ending the war. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu vows to expand the offensive into the Strip's southern city of Rafah, where half of Gaza's population has sought refuge, and to keep fighting until Hamas is dismantled. Aid groups say it is nearly impossible to deliver aid in much of Gaza because of Israeli restrictions, ongoing hostilities, and the breakdown of order. 6 trucks brought humanitarian aid directly into hard-hit northern Gaza on Tuesday morning, coordinated by the Israeli military, which called it a pilot program. And now an article from Haiti. Haiti's prime minister to resign amid violence, gangs want to say as the country prepares for new leadership. Politicians across Haiti scrambled for power Tuesday after Prime Minister Ariel Henry announced he will resign once a transitional presidential council is created. But elbowing their way into the race are powerful gangs that control 80% of Haiti's capital and demand a say in the future of the troubled country under siege. Experts warn that nothing will change unless gangs become part of the conversation. Even if you have a different kind of government, the reality is that you need to talk to the gangs, said Robert Fatten, a Haitian politics expert at the University of Virginia, noting that gangs largely control the capital. If they have that supremacy and there is no countervailing force, it's no longer a question if you want them at the table. They may just take the table. Gangs have deep ties to Haiti's political and economic elite, but they have become more independent, financing their operations with kidnapping ransoms to buy smuggled weapons that allow them to overpower underfunded police. More than 200 gangs are estimated to operate around Haiti. And that does it for the reading of today's Globe Gazette for March 13, 2024. I'm your reader, Craig Shives. Thanks for listening. And now, welcome to the reading of The Messenger for March 13, 2024. On the front page, we find an article entitled Raises Approved for Webster County Officials, No Pay Increase for Supervisors. Some of Webster County's elected officials will be getting 2% raises on July 1. The county supervisors, however, will not be among them. The Board of Supervisors approved the raises for the sheriff, county attorney, auditor, recorder, and treasurer Tuesday morning. There was no debate. Supervisor Nick Carlson was absent from the otherwise unanimous vote. As a result of the raises, these will be the increased salaries for officials when the new fiscal year begins. County Attorney Darren Driscoll, $139,718. Sheriff Luke Fleener, $115,073. Auditor Doreen Pliner, $83,569. Recorder Lindsay Laufersweiler, $83,569. Treasurer Brenda Engstrom, $83,569. The salary of Nikki Conrad, chairwoman of the Board of Supervisors, will remain at $47,407. The salaries of supervisors Mark Campbell, Austin Hayek, Bob Dode, and Carlson will remain at $46,369. The County Compensation Board, which is tasked with recommending raises for the elected officials, proposed a 9.5% raises for the attorney, sheriff, auditor, recorder, and treasurer when it met on January 18. It did not recommend any increases for the supervisors. On the front page, we have another article entitled Big Paving Job Set in Webster County. The Calo Hill and a road leading to Dolliver Memorial State Park will be repaved this year. The Webster County Board of Supervisors on Tuesday hired Fort Dodge Asphalt Company to do the work at a cost of $2,834,030.20. These roads will be repaved. Webster County Road P-59 between Riverside Trail and 255th Street. This road is known locally as the Calo Hill. 255th Street to 260th Street to Dolliver Park Avenue. County Engineer Jamie Joel said the project will take 6 to 8 weeks to complete. He said access for nearby residents will be maintained throughout the project. Supervisor Nick Carlson was absent from the otherwise unanimous vote to award the contract. And again on the front page, an article entitled County Considers New Variance Process, State Grant Received for Wells. Property owners in rural Webster County with projects that fall outside of certain zoning rules by just a short distance may get a new way to obtain a variance. The Planning and Zoning Administrator would be empowered to grant such variances under a measure the County Board of Supervisors approved on first reading Tuesday. As it stands now, any request for a variance from building setback, lot frontage, and depth or building height requirements must be approved by the Board of Adjustment. The proposal advanced on Tuesday would enable the Planning and Zoning Administrator to approve such variances if they are, quote, less than 10% of the qualified dimensional standard or 5 feet, whichever is less, close quote. This is very beneficial because it will cure those very minor requests for dimensional relief, said Planning and Zoning Administrator Jeff Johnson. The measure must be approved once more by the board to become law. In other business, Johnson told the board that his department has received a $50,000 grant from the state for well testing, well closing, and chlorine shocking of wells. Those services can be provided to any resident who has a well. Johnson said a $40,000 grant was received for that purpose last year. And finally on the front page, an article entitled Bill to Limit Purchases of New Public Land Advances in House. Legislation that would prevent state conservation officials from acquiring new public land at auction or through donations from certain groups that obtain it at auction was advanced by an Iowa House subcommittee on Tuesday. Senate File 2324 was approved by the Senate 2 weeks ago with a 30-17 vote and moved to the House. It has been widely condemned by conservation, environmental, and hunting organizations for its potential to limit public land acquisitions and the economic benefits they create for rural Iowa. A similar bill introduced in the House was rejected in early February by a subcommittee and is no longer available for consideration. But the Senate version was recommended 2-1 by a different House subcommittee on Tuesday that was led by the bill's author, Representative Austin Harris, a Republican from Moulton. I find it extraordinarily regrettable, the controversy that has surrounded this bill, and am actually really surprised by it, Harris said. He said the bill is meant to codify an existing policy of the Iowa Department of Natural Resources that generally precludes it from competing for land that is auctioned. Harris insisted the bill would change nothing about public land acquisitions, but would merely ensure the department's policy continues. Opponents disagree and argue there might be situations in which the DNR should be able to buy land at auction, which its policy permits, but the legislation would not. They view the bill as the latest attempt to prevent the DNR from obtaining land for public use at the behest of farm groups. Last year, a bill that ultimately failed amid similar opposition would have prioritized the maintenance of state-owned land over acquisitions. It also passed the Senate, but by a larger margin, and failed to advance from one House committee before it was moved to a subcommittee also led by Harris. The subcommittee recommended the bill, but it did not advance further. The new bill has the support of the Iowa Farm Bureau Federation and the Iowa Cattlemen's Association, which have said the cheaper farmland that is sometimes obtained by the DNR would be better suited to beginning livestock farmers. We believe the government should not be competing against constituents for land at auctions, said Jake Swanson of the association. The bill codifies current DNR practice, which I know is true, and ensures loopholes are not created for entities to purchase land on the state's behalf. The bill would prohibit the DNR from accepting land donations from not-for-profit organizations that obtained the land at auction. Others argued that farmers with lots of land and money are the biggest competitors of beginning and smaller farmers, and that urban sprawl is a greater contributor to farmland losses, especially because it often consumes higher quality land. If the stated problem is that there's a lack of land for farming, then I would presume that our legislation should be going after the biggest problem, not an issue where DNR is trying to, within its very narrow limits and budget, cobble together a semblance of a public lands system, said Representative Austin Baith, a Democrat from Des Moines, a member of the three-person subcommittee who opposed the bill. In a recent five-year period, from fiscal years 2018 to 2022, the DNR bought an annual average of about 3,500 acres, according to DNR records. The average cost per acre was about $2,500. Last year, average farmland values reached a new record of about $11,800 per acre, according to Iowa State University. On page 2 of the Messenger, we find an article entitled U.S. Inflation Up Again in February, in latest sign that price pressures remain elevated. Consumer prices in the United States picked up last month, a sign that inflation remains a persistent challenge for the Federal Reserve and for President Joe Biden's reelection campaign, both of which are counting on a steady easing of price pressures this year. Prices rose 0.4% from January to February, higher than the previous month's figure of 0.3%, the Labor Department said Tuesday. Compared with a year earlier, consumer prices rose 3.2% last month, above January's 3.1% annual pace. Excluding volatile food and energy prices, so-called core prices also climbed 0.4% from January to February, matching the previous month's rise, and a faster pace than is consistent with the Fed's 2% inflation target. Core inflation is watched especially closely because it typically provides a better read of where inflation is likely headed. It's a disappointment, but not a disaster, said Eric Winograd, U.S. economist at Asset Manager AB. The underlying details are more encouraging than the top-line number, which was boosted by a few volatile categories, the type of prices that tend not to repeat month to month. Those volatile items include gas prices, which jumped 3.8% just from January to February, but are still below their level of a year ago. Airfare surged 3.6% after 2 months of much smaller increases. Clothing prices rose 0.6% after 3 months of declines, but are unchanged compared with a year earlier. Housing and rental costs, though, which tend to change more gradually, cooled in February. They rose 0.4% from January, slower than the 0.6% increase the previous month. Measures of new apartment leases, which have cooled, are expected to feed into the government's inflation data in the coming months. New car prices ticked down 0.1% in February, though these prices remain much higher than they were before the pandemic. They're expected to decline further as more vehicles show up on dealer lots. Grocery prices were unchanged last month and are up just 1% from a year earlier. Despite February's elevated figures, most economists expect inflation to continue slowly declining this year. At the same time, the uptick last month may underscore the Fed's cautious approach toward interest rate cuts. Voter perceptions of inflation are sure to occupy a central place in this year's presidential election. Despite a healthy job market and a record-high stock market, polls show that many Americans blame Biden for the surge in consumer prices that began in 2021. Though inflationary pressures have significantly eased, average prices remain about far above where they stood 3 years ago. In his State of the Union speech last week, Biden highlighted steps he has taken to reduce costs, like capping the price of insulin for Medicare patients. The president also criticized many large companies for engaging in price gouging and so-called shrinkflation, in which a company shrinks the amount of product inside a package rather than raising the price. Too many corporations raise prices to pad their profits, charging more and more for less and less, Biden said. Rob Considine, who lives near Minneapolis, said he has noticed shrinkflation in consumer products like deodorant, shampoo, and soap. Considine, 38, said he doubts, though, that Biden's criticism of shrinkflation or proposals in Congress to restrict the practice will have much effect. If companies can't make bars of soap smaller while charging the same price, Considine suggested, they will simply reduce the quality to maintain their profits. I don't know how the government can set a price for a commodity like that without affecting it in the long run, he said. Overall inflation has plummeted from a peak of 9.1% in June 2022, though it's now easing more slowly than it did last spring and summer. The prices of some goods, from appliances to furniture to used cars, are actually falling after clogged supply chains during the pandemic had sent prices soaring higher. There are more new cars on dealer lots and electronics on store shelves. By contrast, prices for dental care, car repairs, and other services are still rising faster than they did before the pandemic. Car insurance has shot higher, reflecting rising costs for repairs and replacement. And after having sharply raised pay for nurses and other in-demand staff, hospitals are passing their higher wage costs on to patients in the form of higher prices. Still, Fed Chair Jerome Powell signaled in congressional testimony last week that the central bank is getting closer to cutting rates. After meeting in January, Fed officials said in a statement that they needed, quote, greater confidence, close quote, that inflation was steadily falling to their 2% target level. Since then, several of the Fed's policymakers have said they believe prices will keep declining. One reason, they suggested, is that consumers are increasingly pushing back against higher prices by seeking out cheaper alternatives. Most economists expect the Fed's first rate cut to occur in June. When the Fed cuts its benchmark rate, over time it reduces borrowing costs for mortgages, car loans, credit cards, and business loans. We find some news briefs on page 3. from Rafah in the Gaza Strip. We find an article entitled, "An Aid Ship Sets Sail to Gaza, Where Hundreds of Thousands Face Starvation 5 Months into War." An aid ship, loaded with some 200 tons of food, set sail for Gaza on Tuesday in a pilot program for the opening of a sea corridor to the territory, where the five-month-old Israel-Hamas war has driven hundreds of thousands of Palestinians to the brink of starvation. The push to get food in by sea, along with a recent campaign of airdrops into isolated northern Gaza, highlighted the international community's frustration with the growing humanitarian crisis and its inability to get aid in by road. The food on the aid ship was collected by World Central Kitchen, the charity founded by celebrity chef Joe Andres, and is being transported by the Spanish aid group Open Arms. The ship departed from the eastern Mediterranean island nation of Cyprus and is expected to arrive in Gaza in 2 to 3 days. The war, triggered by Hamas' October 7 attack on Israel, has killed over 30,000 Palestinians and driven most of Gaza's 2.3 million people from their homes. A quarter of Gaza's population is starving, according to the United Nations, because they cannot find enough food or afford it at vastly inflated prices. And now an article entitled, "Scott Peterson Appears Virtually in California Court as L.A. Innocence Project Takes Up Murder Case." Scott Peterson appeared virtually in court on Tuesday, nearly 20 years after he was convicted of killing his pregnant wife, as his lawyers with the Los Angeles Innocence Project ask a judge to order new DNA tests and allow their investigators to access evidence connected with a burglary across the street from the couple's California home. Peterson was sentenced to death after a jury found him guilty of murder in the deaths of Lacey and the unborn child they planned to name Connor. Prosecutors said he killed Lacey and dumped her body in San Francisco Bay on Christmas Eve 2002. The death sentence was later overturned, and he was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. The L.A. Innocence Project has now taken up Peterson's case. From Haiti, an article entitled, "Haiti is Preparing Itself for New Leadership. Gangs Want a Seat at the Table." Politicians across Haiti are scrambling for power after Prime Minister Ariel Henry announced Tuesday that he would resign once a transitional presidential council is created. But elbowing their way into the race are powerful gangs that control 80% of Haiti's capital and demand a say in the future of the troubled country under siege. No one mentioned the armed groups as Caribbean leaders congratulated themselves late Monday for setting Haiti on a new political path, and experts warned that nothing will change unless gangs become part of the conversation. Even if you have a different kind of government, the reality is that you need to talk to the gangs, said Robert Fatten, a Haitian politics expert at the University of Virginia, noting that gangs largely control the capital. On the opinion page, we find the Messenger editorial, entitled, "Living Liver Donor Story Sets Example of Compassion. The Rest of Us Can Learn from Javi Hernandez." Can you imagine living a big chunk of one of your vital organs? Can you imagine giving a big chunk of one of your vital internal organs to a complete stranger? The mere thought of it probably makes a lot of people queasy. But one local woman did just that in a stunning and heartwarming example of compassion for another human being. Kristen Hubby of Fort Dodge donated 66% of her liver to Isaac Hernandez, a young man in Texas suffering from an autoimmune disorder that attacked his liver. Their story did not end with the April 12, 2022 surgery. Hubby and Hernandez have stayed in touch and even co-authored a children's book for pediatric liver transplant patients. Their real-life saga began when hubby learned that a friend and co-worker's brother needed a new liver. She did some research and learned about the living donation option for liver transplants. Remarkably, she was moved to sign up to be a living liver donor in 2020. More online research followed, and hubby found a post from Hernandez's mother explaining his plight. She volunteered herself, and doctors found her and Hernandez to be a match. The surgery was done in San Antonio, Texas. Hubby and Hernandez wrote their book, which includes advice from a donor and a recipient. Then they formed a nonprofit organization called Little Lambs of Jesus to support the printing and distribution of their book. The story of Kristen Hubby and Isaac Hernandez is an inspiring one. It should inspire the rest of us to be more compassionate to the people around us. If it inspires others to become organ donors, that's wonderful. Being an organ donor isn't for everyone, obviously. But there are lots of other ways to be compassionate to others. Even just saying hello to a stranger might be enough to give a lift to someone having a bad day. At a time when the world seems overcome by anger, violence, and hatred, the example set by these two should move the rest of us toward being kinder and gentler. Now on page 5, some more brief articles. The first, entitled Congressional Hearing on the Biden Classified Documents Probe, turns into a proxy campaign battle. Lawmakers turned a Tuesday hearing on President Joe Biden's handling of classified documents into a proxy battle between the Democratic president and Republican frontrunner Donald Trump, as a newly released transcript of Biden's testimony last fall showed that he repeatedly insisted he never meant to retain classified information after he left the vice presidency. Special Counsel Robert Hur, testifying for more than 4 hours before the House Judiciary Committee, stood steadfastly by the assessments in his 345-page report that questioned Biden's age and mental competence, but recommended no criminal charges for the 81-year-old president, finding insufficient evidence to make a case stand up in court. The transcript of hours of interviews between Biden and the special counsel released Tuesday provide a more textured picture of the roughly year-long investigation, filling in some of the gaps left by hers and Biden's accounting of the exchanges. But there was no guarantee the hearing or transcript would alter preconceived notions about the president, the special counsel who investigated him, or Trump, particularly in a hard-fought election year. And finally, an article entitled Supreme Court Extends Pause on Texas Law That Would Allow State Police to Arrest Migrants. The U.S. Supreme Court extended a pause Tuesday on a Texas law that would allow police to arrest migrants accused of crossing into the country illegally as federal and state officials prepare for a showdown over immigration enforcement authority. Justice Samuel Alito's order extending the hold on the law until Monday came a day before the previous hold was set to expire. The extension gives the court an extra week to consider what opponents have called the most extreme attempt by a state to police immigration since an Arizona law that was partially struck down by the Supreme Court in 2012. U.S. District Judge David Ezra had rejected the law last month, calling it unconstitutional and rebuking multiple aspects of the legislation in a 114-page ruling that also brushed off claims by Texas Republicans of an invasion along the southern border. But a federal appeals court stayed that ruling, and the Justice Department asked the Supreme Court to intervene. Republican Texas Governor Greg Abbott signed the law, known as Senate Bill 4, in December. It is part of his heightened measures along the state's boundary with Mexico, testing how far state officials can go to prevent migrants from crossing into the U.S. illegally after border crossing reached record highs. Senate Bill 4 would also give local judges the power to order migrants arrested under the provision to leave the country or face a misdemeanor charge for entering the U.S. illegally. Migrants who don't leave after being ordered to do so could be arrested again and charged with a more serious felony. In an appeal to the High Court, the Justice Department said the law would profoundly alter the status quo that has existed between the United States and the states in the context of immigration for almost 150 years. U.S. officials have also argued it would hamper the government's ability to enforce federal immigration laws and harm the country's relationship with Mexico. The battle over the immigration enforcement law is one of multiple legal disputes between Texas officials and the Biden administration over the extent to which the state can patrol the Texas-Mexico border to hamper illegal crossings. And that does it for today's reading of The Messenger for March 13, 2024. I'm your reader, Craig Shives. Thank you for listening.